Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast with me, Simone. I'm excited to be here to talk about mental game tidbits part two. So we're going to go into more of the applied interventions. And as I've stated before in other episodes, but I'll resituate it here in this episode. This is actually my level of expertise. I am a professor of sports psychology and coaching classes, and I am actually teaching. I have my textbook opened right now, a psychology of injury class, where I just got done teaching four separate lessons on these specific interventions I'm going to be talking about today. So I've been doing this for years. I've been in the applied space. I'm now in the academic space. So take this as your lecture, if you will. So this isn't just me talking as somebody, and even if I was just speaking as somebody of my lived experience, it's valid. But I just want you to know the credentials that are there, that I have a PhD in sports psychology. I'm also a certified mental performance co consultant through our Association for Applied Sports Psychology. I've been doing this in and out. I've been teaching students this all the time. So buckle up, you get a free lesson from me. I won't be able to go into necessarily major specifics. So this isn't going to be an explicitly applied episode in the sense of us going through the interventions themselves, but I am going to talk about these interventions that you can use, talk about how I use them on my Nutcracker journey specifically, and I'll be linking some things in show notes, resources for that you can use if you would like to. So again, I'm just inviting you to do some things I've done. This is not being prescriptive. This is not me saying you have to take the journey that I took or am taking. It's just me giving you some options, and that's it. And I know in this vascular compression space, that's what's so overwhelming is we just have, there's not really people giving us options. There's not a lot of resources. So in this episode, I'm going to go over four different interventions, and I will talk about each of them individually. So the first of that being goal setting. Then we'll talk about self-talk, adaptive versus maladaptive self-talk. We'll get into some relaxation techniques, and then we'll end talking about visualization and imagery. Okay, I'll try putting the timestamps in the show notes as well, just in case you're like, "Yeah, I don't want to listen to goal setting. I just want to jump to the last three." A-okay with me. You also can just stop listening to this episode right now if you want. Doesn't really matter to me. It's what works for you. And if you do like this episode, obviously share it with all your vascular compression besties or maybe any other chronic illness besties that you have. This isn't just specific to Nutcracker syndrome. So to start, goal setting. I'll be honest with you, it's kind of funny. Like, I don't, as a mental performance coach, I don't necessarily sit down with a client and be like, let's do goal setting. Because I feel like we do set goals implicitly as we're going. So, but I will say it's, and here's an example of how I implicitly did it for myself. I never really sat down and was like, what are my goals on this Nutcracker syndrome journey? I did sit down and cry a lot. You know, like that's what I did do. But I never really sat down and was like, let me create a performance plan, a mental performance plan for this Nutcracker journey. I never did that. I mean, just so y'all know, I don't want to paint the picture of like I'm an expert in this field, and so I use this as like a mental performance case study. Not at all. Sometimes I look back and I'm like, man, I could have gotten some good research publications out of this. But again, the time I scheduled for myself was just not even scheduled. It was just impromptu crying. So the goals, though, retroactively looking back, so one thing I'll talk about, so goals in and of themselves are just obviously, as you know, it's just setting these goals that you can achieve. And I feel like intuitively what I'm about to say, you don't need a textbook, you don't need a professor to tell you this, but having process-oriented goals, like obviously having the outcome-oriented goal. So my outcome was to get an auto transplant, was to get the surgery. However, we all know that there's a lot of uncontrollables in there. Is a surgeon even going to accept me to get this surgery? If not, what's plan A? What's plan B? Right? What's plan B plus plan C? Sorry. So there's a lot of uncontrollables, right? Like, am I even going to get the initial consult? And if I do, are they even going to accept me for surgery? If I get accepted for surgery, is insurance even going to approve it? Like, gosh, I'm exhausted just thinking about that. It's a lot. It's a lot. It's a lot. But the goals that I set, and again, at the time I didn't even realize they were really goals. I would joke with people, and it really wasn't a joke. I felt like it was my full-time job. I was putting more hours into my medical journey than I was to my own job. Thankfully, I have a job that's flexible, for me to be able to do that. I clocked 5,000 miles of just medical travel from doctor's appointments around the Denver metro area. That didn't even include us flying to Madison, Wisconsin for the UW health appointment. But what I did when I was doing full time is I went into professor mode. Like I treated it like it was a job. I had a separate notebook, and what I would do every day is I would write down the things that I wanted to do, and sometimes that was literally just gently and friendly following up with doctors' offices. Hey, I just wanted to, call, see if you got my referral. Hey, this is Simone. I just wanted to see if you all did have any cancellations. If so, that would be great. If not, I'll call tomorrow and the next day. I mean, I was very gentle about it, obviously. They started to get to know me, but those were my goals, was just, and it kept me busy. And I think the thing with it, there's like kind of this fine line of like, I just needed to stay distracted or else I was going to get in my own head. So, what are the goals that you have for the X's and O's of the medical journey? So, whether it's calling the doctor's offices, again, I was calling every day, every other day. I was also calling, like, if I would get the referral, something else I would do is they would say, oh, give it 24 to 48 hours for the referral to go to. Your girl here would not allow that. I would actually call that doctor's office and say, hey, I just had a referral sent in. I know it takes 24 to 48 hours for that referral process, but I wanted to get ahead of the curve here. What do you all need from me records-wise? Do you all already have access to health images records? If not, do I need to request those? Do you have access to X, Y, and Z medical facilities? If not, I'll request those. So I got it. I didn't wait. I never waited around for them to tell me what to do. I called and initiated the conversation because, as we all know, the waiting game in the medical space, like I didn't want it to be on me on why we had to wait more. Like I didn't want to show up to the initial consult and then be like, oh, well, we don't have those images. I wanted to already have the images there. So those were the type of technical goals that I set for the medical journey. Some of the other goals I set, because as we all know, we don't necessarily have like this, I mean, bring in the spoons theory, baby. Like our spoons are small. Like if you go grocery shopping, which I was using one of those motorized scooters to help alleviate some of the spoons being expended, we don't have a lot of energy to go out. Like I didn't have a social life. Let's be real. I had just moved to a new place. I was trying to make new friends, and nobody wanted to be friends with me because I was sick. And I also didn't want to engage in trying to make friends with anybody because I was sick. But the people that I did have connections with, like something I did was made it a goal that once a week or every other week, I call somebody or schedule a phone conversation. And another thing that I want to add on to that, that my goal, because everybody be like, how are you doing? Oh my gosh, blah. Because I was very outward on my social media about what I was going through. My goal as well was to situate the conversation not just around me. And what I mean by that is, I had my friend Jessie that I was talking to, and she was like, oh my gosh, girl, how are you doing? And I said, can I just request that we don't talk about me? I just want to hear about you. And then she went on to tell me about the drama, whatever, that stuff you chat about in her life. And it was so amazing to be able to disconnect from my world and to step into somebody's world. So the goal, think about goals technically that you're setting. So calling the doctor's office, following up, managing your medical records. I had a whole nother page just like, you can even create an Excel spreadsheet. Now that I'm thinking about it, that would have been more efficient. Of having like, okay, these are the medical records that I've requested. And then having a column of have they been requested? Check yes, they have. Were they received? Check yes. Calling those doctor's offices, hey, just wanted to see if you've received them or not. If not, I'll follow up. Like it was just a lot of me following up, me being the one to keep people on track. Did things fall through the cracks? If so, where was the crack? How can we alleviate it? There was a lot. I wish I could go back and almost like calculate how many minutes, how many hours I was on the phone. That's the technical. Then the social aspect, making sure that you are creating those gentle plans for yourself. I had friends that would come to me, which was lovely. They'd come over and I would literally be laying on the couch in my sea of heating pads. And we just sit and chat. And they'd bring over, like, I wasn't drinking at the time, because that would exacerbate, I'm really not drinking now, that would exacerbate my symptoms. And so they would bring over some wine. I would have my, cranberry juice or whatever it was, treat it like it was wine, and we would just have our nice little chitty chats. And I would try to very much set boundaries and be like, hey, like, let's just plan for you to be here for an hour. If it goes a little longer, I'll let you know, just so that they were aware. Because as we all know, when you're dealing with friends, with family that's never dealt with chronic illness like this, it's really hard for them to wrap their head around. So, some of that was just communicating with them, like getting ahead of it and saying, yeah, let's just plan that you're over there for an hour. If that hour kind of comes around and things are going great, I'll let you know. And it would, a lot of times I'd be like, yeah, you can stay longer. I'm feeling great. Like, as long as we're sitting here. And sometimes I would feel good enough to be like, or if I had to go grocery shopping, they would come with me on my little chore, my errand runs. So there were ways that people, my support system, I was able to kind of set those goals or reframe my life to have them come to me and meet me where I was at. Something I also did and goals that I set weirdly was not setting, like, I had one friend that I, like, months out, I had gone to this con was going to go to this concert, and I would feel so much shame when I would have to cancel. So some goals I set weren't even, like, my goal was to not anything that had me getting out and going doing anything. I just told people, like, it's a game time decision, it's a game time decision. So some goals were not even, like, my social goals was actually saying no to a lot of things. And then letting them know game time if I would feel good enough to go do it. And some of that was me figuring out, okay, do I have a couple days, like, are some of the days after, like, pretty light, and making sure I keep them light so I could just stay horizontal most days. So thinking about that for yourself, what are the goals that you are setting? And being organized, I think, is one way that we can alleviate that mental overwhelm that we experience. I know that I was super overwhelmed. That's why I had to write everything down, put check marks next to things, highlight stuff, set reminders on my phone. Kyle was like, you're a one-woman circus orchestra going on here with, he's like, I don't know how you're keeping up with all this. And I was like, I don't either. I just know that I have to get it out of my brain and I have to write it down. And when I write it down, it almost creates this, like, mental clarity. It creates more room for me to just rest and relax, because the hamster wheel was just going, 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 going. So that was a goal. I also want to talk about setting mental health goals, and maybe that's a goal of, like, setting up seeing a therapist. Something I wish I would have done prior, and you all can refer to the medication episode that I recorded. I just started antidepressants a week ago as of the recording of this episode. I wish I would have actually done that sooner. I'm only been on it a week, and they usually say it takes 3 to 4, or sorry, 2 to 3 to 4 weeks for it to implement. Maybe it's a placebo effect, but I can already feel that hamster wheel just, like, chilling out. The hamster is off the wheel and I'm calm. And I'm looking back like, yeah, I think I needed some antidepressants. So some of your goals, like, think about mental goals that you have. Even listening to this episode, it could be a goal. But sitting down and writing down your goals and really fleshing them out, and then communicating what those goals are to your support system, and maybe even delegating some of those goals. I know it would have been so helpful for me if I would have had somebody that was like, hey, I'll actually take over finding the Airbnb for you. I'll take over looking up the resources for you, etc. I did have some people reach out that did send me things, which was super helpful. But do know, like, setting the goals, it could obviously be for you, but it could also be for delegating for your social support and saying, hey, like, these are the goals I have. Is there anything else that you could help with? Maybe it's nutritional goals that you have. We all know that, like, I'm still struggling with loss of appetite and nausea, so I'm not really getting the caloric intake that I need. So I'm meeting with a registered dietitian for us to kind of set up a meal plan, talk about different foods that I can eat, and set goals for that. Like, and just maybe the goal is to just inch up my caloric intake by eating those calorie dense foods, and seeing what I can and can't tolerate. So again, it's loose, right? Like some of y'all might be know of what SMART goals are, you know, like making like the S is for specific, M is for measurable, A attainable, R relatable, and T time sensitive, or what's the time frame on it. You're more than welcome to do that as well. But I think just really sitting down and coming up with a game plan of like, what are your process-oriented goals week to week, you know, and maybe that's looking at your schedule and working backwards on, okay, I have my upcoming appointment with such and such. So let me make sure they have the scans that they need to be prepared for that. Maybe it's writing down all the questions you have. Like those in and of themselves are goals. They are things that you want to achieve, right? You want to get answers to. So that really helped me. It kept me distracted. It made me kind of view the medical space like a job, and helped me advocate for myself. So I hope some of those, the things that I did at least during that process can really help you feel like, okay, yeah, maybe you're already like, oh, I'm doing that. You're on the right track then. Like, take this as validation that you are doing what you can, and knowing like, oh, somebody else was doing the same thing, or you're like, oh, this is awesome. Actually, I didn't think about that, and see if it works. Everything I'm telling you here is me just inviting you to try it. You don't even have to try it if you don't want. With that said, just try it, and if it works for you, great. If it doesn't, you can stop at any point. You are in the driver's seat. Just remember that. So that's goal setting. Now I want to transition into self-talk. So self-talk is something that has been very powerful for me. I still am having to kind of reframe self-talk for me. So just to define what self-talk is, it could be, you know, you're probably like, eh, it says it in the name. But it's what you say to yourself either out loud. I actually speak out loud to myself more often than not, or more often than I would like to admit. Either out loud to yourself or that small voice that's inside of your head. And oftentimes, self-talk and how we talk to ourselves is heavily influenced by the environment that we were raised in. It is very much nurtured. So if you grew up in a household that had a lot of negative self-talk, similar to my household, very shaming household, even your friends, right? Like, I adopted that. That soaked into the fabric of my being, even without me wanting it to. And I really had to take ownership of reframing, of holding myself accountable to switching the unproductive self-talk to more productive. So I know I just used the word negative, which insinuates the opposite of that being positive. I'm going to try to avoid those words because positive and negative are very subjective terms that society has liked to infiltrate. So I like to use unproductive and productive because some pe what's productive for some people might be unproductive for others, and what's unproductive for others might be productive for others. So I'm going to try to speak in generalizations. I'm not going to say like this is what you should be saying to yourself, but I want to invite you into a space to start thinking about what you are saying to yourself. And sometimes that starts by noticing and accepting what is the unproductive self-talk? So some things I do with clients is say, hey, let's sit down with a journal and just have a full week of honesty, of just writing down what are you saying to yourself? Is it should to, have to, ought to statements? Oh, like I should have done that. I should have called yesterday. Gosh, I should have called to see if there was any cancellations. I should have, you know, I should have thought to ask about that test and I didn't. I had a lot of that. And I would be like, oops, okay. I mean, because of my years of training, I was like, so I just want y'all to know, while I am like situating myself as an expert with a lowercase e in this space, I am still having to hold myself accountable. So this is a lifelong journey. This isn't something that you just achieve one day and like, you know, aha, I'm great. But it's a practice of being gentle with yourself. So I would suggest starting with just like a week, and maybe even again, like I was talking about with goal setting, if you have the Excel spreadsheet, if you have a journal that you're using, like having a section of just self-talk, like what are you saying to yourself? How are you beating yourself up? How are you not being gentle with yourself? And sometimes an easy way of doing this is maybe thinking about like just writing down everything as it comes and trying to be non-judgmental about that. So approaching it with a mindful acceptance. If you've practiced mindfulness before, maybe even like waking up, getting yourself in a very present-centered, non-judgmental space to be able to accept these things you're saying to yourself, not beating yourself up for the things you're beating yourself up about, right? Like, let's not take that meta approach of like, okay, I'm beating myself up saying this, and now I'm beating myself up that I'm even using these phrases. No, it's just about let's be honest with ourselves because the goal, so bringing in goals here with self-talk, the first step is just accepting what we are saying to ourselves. I had a lot of ableism coming forward. Of course, we live in a capitalistic productive society, so when you are somebody who can't produce to the same level you were, a lot of those inherent ableistic sayings are gonna, like, I started feeling unworthy. I started feeling worthless. A lot of my internal dialogue was that, like, I am less than. I remember thinking, like, Kyle's gonna break up with me because I can't contribute to this family dynamic. He doesn't wanna take care of me. Like, even to that level of things that I was saying to myself, writing those down and then learning to reframe them or even using them as a space for dialogue with your support system. So I, me sitting down with Kyle and saying, hey, these are some thoughts that are popping in my head. Can we discuss them? I'm not saying they're true. I'm just saying it's the narrative that I'm telling myself. Can we talk about it? And that actually led to some really productive conversations between him and I. And some of them were hard. Some of them were setting boundaries for him because it was all consuming for him. It was dragging him down. So me learning to say, hey, do you have the space right now to talk about my medical stuff? Sometimes he would say no. And I'll be honest with you, I was a little like, excuse you. But that was like my first, and I was like, oh, okay. I was like, cool. Then I started creating my support group that I found on the Facebook group. So I would text them, be like, hey, can we chat right now? So that would alleviate some of the, so that was another goal, was expanding my support group. That's why I got, so revisiting that goal setting, and I'll probably kind of intermingle some of these others across the board here. Going to the Facebook group and finding social support people that I could talk to. I started texting with people. That helped alleviate a lot of the pressure off Kyle. And a lot of that started by me making that list of things I was saying to myself, which led to productive dialogue with my partner and helped us create healthier boundaries so that we could protect the health of our relationship to the extent that we could protect it. It was a roller coaster, let me say the least. But when it comes to reframing, I really want, so having that week or even a day, if you want, of just being honest with yourself of what are the things you're saying to yourself. And it could be positive, it could be productive too, right? Maybe there's productive things you're saying, but the things that you deem as unproductive, the things that aren't gentle, the things that, and I like to frame it this way, the things you write down. If you had somebody else chronically ill come to you, would you say those same statements to them? And if the answer is no, then that means it's likely unproductive. Okay? If you deem it unproductive, maybe put like a red X next to it or something, and the things you deem productive, maybe highlight that in green, whatever you want. If you want to color code, just throw an inspiration out there. The unproductive self-talk, reframing it to productive. So again, taking that same, a concept of you speaking to somebody else with a chronic illness, what, how could you reframe that unproductive self-talk to something productive you would say to them? It's easier for us to take a third person point of view and think about, because we're often more kind to somebody else than we are to ourselves, and we have to remember that. So thinking about that, how can we be more productive, speak more productively to somebody else, and then adopting that for ourselves and writing specifically. I actually like writing things hand, like pencil to paper, pen to paper. You have a 40% higher retention rate in doing that versus typing it, just so you know. It's what the research shows. With that being said, so writing that down again, if you want to do it in your Excel spreadsheet, and then making it a conscious habit, very intentionally making it a conscious habit to adopt those. And what I mean by intentionally is a couple of things. I would wake up and actually read those reframes to myself. Sometimes it would be like, my body, I'm doing the best I can. I'm showing up for my body in a compassionate way today. I am listening to my body. I love my body in the state that it is in. My body is fighting for itself because it loves me. I mean, those were the type of things I was saying to myself. And sometimes I would have to I would start out with like a relaxation technique. We'll transition into that in the next section. So again, all of these are very intermingled. I would ground myself in the present moment. I would get myself in my non-judgmental space. And I would say, like, I would use my breathing patterns, breathing in the productive self-talk and then breathing it out. And sometimes I would do it multiple times per phrase until I really felt like I was like marinating in it. I really accepted it. And so I would do that, and it would really help shift me into what we call a parasympathetic state, which is a rest and digest space. I felt like it helped bring my blood pressure down. It brought my heart rate down, and that helped my vascular compression symptoms. There's a lot of research on the mind-body connection, whereas when we do have mental anxiety about what is going on, it does turn the volume up on the pain. It turns that little knob up on pain. And we can, through, bless my soul. Okay, my apologies. Thank you. When we use these type of mental game tidbits that I'm giving you here, it helps us turn that knob down 1 to 2. Again, it's not all in your head, you're not crazy, but there is some control that we do have over that pain scale. So that is what I want to invite you to think about with self-talk. I'm even scrolling through my textbook now just to make sure there's not any last minute things that I'm forgetting. One thing I do want to say about self-talk, so there is like a self-one and self-two. So I'm referencing a book called The Inner Game of Tennis. It's actually a really short book. I recommend it for everybody, even with athletes. I'm like, it doesn't matter what sport you're in, it's applicable to you. And I also just think it's a powerful book for anybody. Again, it's a short book. I think I read it in a day. And I'm a very slow reader, just so y'all know. Self-one is that like snap thought you have when anything happens. It's your implicit bias. That's usually where your immediate gut wrench reaction self-talk comes from. And then self-two is kind of that logical rational that comes in and you're like, eh, no. So self-one is really where that honest hour is at. That's really where the honest self-talk is at, where you're gonna, what is your knee-jerk reaction? Like tapping into that and writing down the reality of self-one's self-talk. Self-two is where you come in and really like bring in your rational frontal lobe brain on how to reframe. So every single one of this have that have the self-one, self-two. Everybody. I worked in professional baseball. Major League Baseball players have this, okay? Everybody, I think that's the thing, is like, oh, Major League Baseball players, those that are like top CEO executives, they are not confident at all. They're all confident, they're all productive self-talk. Not at all. If anything, they actually have, I would argue that their hamster and their hamster wheel is like blah, 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 even more so than most. So norm, I want to normalize that for you, that there's nothing wrong with you. That self-one and those thoughts you have, everybody has them. It's just a matter of us mindfully accepting them, not judging them. That's where we need to reframe, is really into this acceptance of who we are and just accepting that this is the version of myself now, and I love this version of myself now. Even though it's hard to love, even though it's painful, I'm still going to sit with this version of myself. So, that is what I wanted to share. Let me make sure here that there's not anything else. That is self-talk. Now I want to transition into relaxation techniques. Again, I'm going to be kind of intermingling these four different, we talked about goal setting, self-talk, now relaxation techniques. I intersperse them across the board with each other. So relaxation techniques, again, I've talked about mindfulness, so that present-centered focus that's non-judgmental, using your breath as the anchor, that is one. But some examples, so relaxation, just to begin with, to define it for you, and again, I know implicitly it might make sense for you all, but it's a temporary but deliberate withdrawal from everyday activity that aims to moderate and function our sympathetic nervous system, which is usually activated under stress. So your sympathetic nervous system is activated by stress. Chronic illness, baby, is stressful. Relaxation is an intervention you can use to try to mitigate that stress, lower the stress response so that we can get into our parasympathetic state, which is the rest and digest state. When we are in that relaxed state, it de so when relaxed, it will exhibit more normal blood pressure, decreases in oxygen co consumption, decreases in respiratory heart rate, decreases in muscle tension. And as we all know, there's a lot of tension in our world, mental tension, physical tension. So some of the things I'll talk about are the interventions I've used with clients, but also with myself heavily to help me survive the onslaught that was Nutcracker, that was my auto transplant, even now post-operatively. I'm looking at 5 months, 5.5 months post-op now as of the recording of this episode. So some of the things that I used was progressive muscle relaxation, guided imagery, which actually we'll get into imagery in more detail in the next portion of this. Diaphragmatic breathing was a big one for me, a very daily, almost hourly thing that I used. And so we'll talk about those. We'll also talk about mindfulness. Now, what I want to start out with, though, is the concept of compassion. And it's becoming a more widely researched variable within the research as it pertains to relaxation, which I love. I love that it is. One of the reasons why, especially in the sports world, okay, so if any of you have been athletes or in the sports world, sports can be kind of toxic. The word compassion isn't necessarily a buzzword, if you will. So the fact that it's starting to make waves, especially in the sport world, I'm like, oh, thank you. I want you to really think about compassion for yourself. And maybe that's taking a third party point of view and how you would like compassion for other people, but we have to first start intrapersonally before we seek things interpersonally. So if we're not willing to give something to ourselves, it's not that we shouldn't expect it from others, of course, but it becomes so much more disappointing when we don't get it from others. And so, how can we realize that we actually can build that compassion for ourselves? And engaging in relaxation training is such a compassionate act. And so, even just like listening to this episode, I think is compassion. Even just educating yourself, advocating yourself, so much compassion there. So, I just want to say, you already are compassionate for yourself. You're not approaching this episode or even listening to what I'm saying right now and not having compassion for self. So give yourself some credit, give yourself some grace, and then realizing that you are building that compassion muscle for yourself that really, really helped me. The more compassionate I was for myself, the more easy I was able to say no to people. I didn't get FOMO. I didn't feel guilt for having to cancel plans. I actually got really good at it, like almost where I'm like, I need to stop saying no because I need friends. So engaging that compassion, and one of the things, and I'll actually link this in the show notes, is a loving kindness meditation. I loved doing this. It helped get me out of a victim mindset and not saying that you're in a, oh my gosh, you're playing the victim card. But it is hard when you are in chronic illness and you're living in a society that discriminates against disabled people, to feel like your worth and stuff is attached to it. Loving kindness really fosters sending loving kindness to self, also sending loving kindness to others. And that really helped me transform into more a compassionate space. So I'll link that for you all in the show notes. But progressive muscle relaxation, I want to talk about that more specifically. I'll also link a couple of these in the show notes as well. Is where you very intentionally will you'll do it's a very body scan, so start at the top of your head down to your feet, and as you are going down and you're scanning your body, you will tense specific body parts for about 7 to 10 seconds. You'll tense them up really, really tight on your in-breath, and then on your out-breath, you will relax them. And so that actually really helped me because I realized sometimes we don't realize how much we are holding tension in parts of our bodies that aren't even associated with the injured, quote unquote, body part, like the left renal vein compression. I was using it. I had a lot of musculoskeletal problems because of the collaterals that were in my spine, a lot of chest problems. So I was holding a lot of tension in my face, in my neck, in my mid back, in my low back, in my legs, I mean in my hips. I mean it was everywhere. So the progressive muscle relaxation did help me feel like I was able to relax parts of my body that even though they were referred pain and they were kind of involved in the stress response, I was able to relax those, which did help me feel like the pain was decreasing. Also just breath control. Like I think diaphragmatic breathing has really helped me. And something I also want to talk about relaxation, you don't have to do like a 5 to 10 minute session. You can just legitimately do 2 to 3 quality breaths, similar to how I end most of these episodes where I say, hey, before we end, let's just take a nice deep breath in through our nose, maybe even hold it for a second up top, and then through your mouth, more slowly exhale, grounding ourselves into the moment. If you do that 2 to 3 times, that is even enough to give our bodies the oxygen for us to rejuvenate ourselves. So I would do things like anytime I'm at a stoplight, anytime I'm waiting on an elevator, if a commercial comes on, for those of you like myself and some of the streaming services that don't have it fully paid for, breathing through that. If we're, I mean, anytime we're waiting, like just being like, oh, I'm just sitting here looking around. Let me actually focus on my breath and take some deep breaths. Every time you do that, you're sharpening your sword. So don't underestimate that. But I'll also put a video example, I'll link in the show notes, of just how to use diaphragmatic breathing, walking you through that. So you want to make sure that you're filling the most days we're only using 20% of our lungs capacity. So when we're intentionally using the breath, we are filling the entirety of our lungs. So feeling, you'll feel your belly rise and your ribs expand, your chest will rise, your shoulders even will rise a little bit, and then slowly exhale that out. So I'll put a diaphragmatic breathing exercise in there for you just to teach you how to do it if you've never done it before. If you have, I just invite you to do that. Something I really like, and I use this with diaphragmatic breathing, is a specific breathing pattern called ratio breathing. It is one that has been demonstrated in the research, and this doesn't, I don't like overgeneralizing research because everybody's body is different. So I'll give you two different types of breathing patterns here. Ratio breathing is a 1 to 2 pattern. So what that means is think about breathing in for a count of 3, 2, 3. And then breathing out for a count of 6, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In for a count of 3, 2, 3, out for a count of 6. I personally prefer the 4 to 8. In for a count of 4, 2, 3, 4, out for a count of 8, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And keeping with that ratio breathing pattern, it's actually demonstrated that when we exhale twice as long as the inhale, it calms the body down. So think about whenever you're let's say a bear's chasing you, right? You're just like, that's definitely going to engage the sympathetic nervous system. Okay. So when we can breathe in and have a twice as long exhale, you're definitely not going to be using ratio breathing if a bear is chasing you. Okay. So the twice as long on the exhale really engages the parasympathetic nervous system because it sends the message to our amygdala, to other parts of our brain, that we are not in a fear response. We are in a chill relaxation response because we're actually in an environment where we have enough time to exhale twice as long. Now, if you try the ratio breathing for yourself and you're like, I don't like this, just don't feel right, that's fine. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with you at all. Do a 1 to 1 ratio. Do an in for a count of 4, 2, 3, 4, out for a count of 4, 2, 3, 4, in for a count of 4. You get the idea. Staying with that pattern. Try it. Set your clock, even if you want just your stopwatch for a minute on each of these, and just see what feels are best for you. Whatever feels best, that's what's right for you. You could even do 5 for 5. So play around with the 1 to 1. You could do in for a count of 5, out for a count of 5. There's also box breathing, which is really fun. Or I'll do like a, it's a 4 by 1 by 4 by 1. But what that means, in for a count of 4, hold for 1, out for a count of 4, hold for 1. In for a count of 4, hold for 1, out for a count of 4, hold for 1. You can even play with that and do in for a count of 5, hold for 1, out for a count of five, hold for one. Do that for a minute. And just see, another one you can do too is like in for a count of four, hold for four, out for a count of four, hold for four. In for a count of four, hold for four, out for a count of four, hold for four. Or again, in for a count of five, hold for five, out for a count of five, hold for five. Try those different breathing patterns. Set your stopwatch for a minute and just see what feels right for you. That is going to be the breathing pattern that works best for you. Now, everything we've talked about, diaphragmatic breathing. So the diaphragmatic breathing, you can use those breathing patterns with, okay? So I like to place a hand on my belly and a hand on my chest, making sure you're filling your lungs at the bottom first. So you feel your belly expand first and your chest or your ribs expand, then your chest rise a little bit. And then out for a count of four, your chest goes down, your ribs collapse back in, your belly goes down. In for a count of four, belly goes out. So this is how you can merge those. Now, all of what we're talking about is kind of a mindful act. And so the breath is an anchor to the present moment. There's no way the breath can live in the future, and there's no way the breath can live in the past, okay? It's always in the present. So if you ever find yourself anxious about the future, worried about the past, right? Like, I remember being anxious having my initial consult and then anxious about getting the phone call and if they were going to accept me. But then also, like, thinking about how the initial consult went and wishing I would have said X, Y, and Z. In those moments when you notice you're living in the future and the past, which is where a lot of anxiety lives because we can't control that, using the breath, mindfully bringing yourself back to the present moment. Again, the breath only lives in the present moment. And what I tell athletes, optimal performance only lives in the present moment, and using the breath to bring you into optimal present moment awareness and also engaging in non-judgment. This is where that compassion piece comes in. So just using the diaphragmatic breathing, using your particular breathing pattern that works for you to sharpen your sword, bring yourself into the present moment. Now, something I like to do with clients when I walk them through meditations, or just mindfulness practice, is as we're focusing on the breath, that deep inhale for four, exhale for four. As you're focusing on your breath, and I would invite you to close your eyes, just focus on that breath. One thing I do personally is I actually envision and visualize. So here I'm bringing in the imagery that we're going to talk about next in more detail. I visualize my trying to connect my heart with my head, and my heart is the color red and my head is the color blue. So as I breathe in, I'm bringing up that red paint color that is my heart, bringing it up into my head space. And as I exhale, bringing on that blue paint that is my brain, bringing it down into the heart space and continuing with that cycle, visualizing on the inhale more and more that red paint of my heart just coming up into my head, and as I exhale, that blue paint color of my brain coming down. And as I continue that cycle, it starts to mix together, maybe creating the color of purple sometimes. And I know this isn't color theory, sometimes it'll create the color gold. I just go with it. There are no rules in art. And I'll do that until that color mix completion happens. And I'll feel a good mind-body connection. I'll feel more solid in myself. Something else that I will do is while you're doing that deep inhale, if you notice these kind of intrusive thoughts coming in, maybe sensations, maybe noises that are taking your attention away from the present moment, non-judgmentally notice them. And I will talk to a client about visualizing on the inhale, putting that intrusive thought onto a cloud. Gently, non-judgmentally, and on the exhale, blowing that cloud away. Maybe doing that a couple times. Inhaling, you see that cloud with the intrusive thought, blowing it away even more. Inhaling, noticing the thought on the cloud. Exhaling, blowing it away even more until it is far away, it is out of your consciousness, and then bringing yourself gently back into the present moment, just focusing on that breath. And any time an intrusive thought comes, isolating it on a cloud, very gently, lovingly, compassionately, Inhaling it, putting it on the cloud, exhaling it, blowing it away. If it's a sensation, if it's pain, using that same imagery of the cloud, of blowing it away out of your existence. Or maybe even something I've done is like my left renal vein, my left flank pain. When I would be doing these meditations, if that pain in my left renal vein, my left flank pain was hurting, I would put my hands on that area. And instead of maybe willing it away, I would say, I see you, and I'm breathing in, sending it loving kindness. I feel you, I see you, I'm advocating for you. Exhaling, I'm see you, I feel you, I'm advocating for you. May we be happy, may we be healthy, may we be free from suffering. Just sitting with the pain, sending it love. So those are some of many things that you can do that I wanted to give you as far as mindfulness. But when you notice if it's hard to sit in that present moment, just it's understanding that there's ways that we can say, hey, like I'm going to put you on a cloud, I'm going to blow you away, I'll revisit you later, but right now I'm just sharpening my sword, I'm bringing myself into a parasympathetic state. Imagery is, and we'll get into it, but this relaxation imagery, there are, and I'm actually going to make note for me to put pain management relaxation into the show notes for you. There's some specific things that you can do there for pain management, for healing as well. So that is relaxation. Now I want to transition into imagery. And again, all of these are very intimately connected. Excuse me. So for starters, to define imagery, slash, I use visualization and imagery interchangeably. It's a cognitive process that involves creating or recreating an object, scene, sensation, event, or activity experience as though it were occurring in overt physical reality. And the visualization process is generated from memorial information that stems from the past and may take place in the future. So it's a clear mental picture of a situation. Now, in our case with chronic illness with pain, there is a lot of us being able to use imagery, so specific healing imagery. Which is, so there's different kinds, actually six different kinds of imagery. So here we are lecturing. Here's some bullet points for you. So healing imagery, which is visualizing and feeling the injured body part healing itself. So I use this a lot, with once I had my auto transplant, and also once I had my Mathurner stent placed. There's pain management imagery, which is assisting you to cope with the pain associated with the imagery. So, talking about that, there's very much kind of that relaxation imagery for pain management, very much goes into this. There's rehabilitation process imagery, which is assisting you in dealing with the possible challenges during the rehab process. I did this a lot actually while I was inpatient. And then there's compassion-focused imagery, which is showing affection towards yourself and others. And also, I want to add to this your injured body part. So this was showing compassion to my incision that I had, to some of the pain that would pop up postoperatively, to some of the pain that would pop up preoperatively. And then there's let's see, these other two, like there's dynamic motor imagery, which is physically executing an intended movement. So some of that I actually used when I was getting back into the gym. And another thing is performance imagery, which is practicing physical skills and imagining yourself performing successfully imagery. Some of that was actually, again, I'm not performing skills, but it was me imagining myself returning back to life and allowing myself to feel comfortable in that so that I didn't necessarily have anxiety getting back to it. What I specifically want to focus on, I've talked about that compassion component with the imagery, so that I'll, with the relaxation, it's the same thing with imagery. So imagining giving yourself loving kindness as well as imagining giving other people loving kindness. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be free of suffering. Maybe even imagine a golden light entering your body as you're giving yourself happiness, loving kindness, and sending that golden light to others. May they be happy. They be free from suffering, and maybe they'd be healthy. Healing imagery, more specifically, is really one of the things I would recommend is when you do have any treatment you're going to have, specifically asking the surgeon about the mechanisms or any of the tendings about the mechanisms of healing. So what, like for example, with the auto transplant, I was told it takes a full 3 months for everything to like bind to itself. I don't know the technical terms, but like for the artery to like fully bind to the other arteries and the ureter to bind to the bladder. So like once I hit the 3 month, I was good there. I wasn't in like, hey, like something like if you go too hard, these things are gonna like separate and you're gonna have an emergency surgery. So specifically asking them about the mechanisms of healing so that you can specifically like as you're breathing in that breathing pattern, right? If it's a count of four, a count of five, breathing in, you visualize sending blood and oxygen to the areas that need it most. And as that blood's there, it's doing its little, I always think about little workers in there, like sewing up those arteries and sewing up the ureter. And as you exhale, it's taking away the inflammation from that area. Breathing in, that oxygen goes there with the blood. Little workers are sewing, patching everything up. As you exhale, it's bringing the inflammation from the area. So that's one way that you can engage with healing imagery as you are navigating your post-op journey. And then pain management is very much, I remember day five having the one of the worst pain days. So a lot of it was just compassionately sitting with, it was mostly my incision that was hurting. So just being like, really letting it know I was there. I would talk out loud to my incision. I'd be like, we're here, it's okay, we're gonna get through this. So and again, I will link a visualization kind of pain management relaxation imagery script for you in the show notes. So you see how all of these are very interdispersed, interconnected. A lot of the meditations that I've done as it comes to injury, pain management, visualization and relaxation, healing imagery and relaxation, a lot of them start out with kind of a grounding, mindful practice of just bringing yourself to the center and being non-judgmental and then moving into the imagery itself. Because the imagery is going to be more powerful when you are centered in the present moment. When you are in a compassionate, non-judgmental space, then you can lean in because it's a very vulnerable thing, especially doing pain management, relaxation, and visualization scripts. One of the things we as humans like to do is we like to distract ourselves out from our pain. We like to dissociate from it. So the pain management and healing, relaxation and imagery scripts themselves are actually calling us into a vulnerable space to acknowledge head on, to actually come into relationship with, and that can be really challenging. So be in connection with yourself. If these are things that you get into and it feels too much, it is okay. It's not a failure at all for you to say, you know what, right now is not the time. That is also fine. I've had clients do that and I say, awesome. Thank you for that feedback. Thank you for compassionately letting me know what you need and setting that boundary right now. So just know that there are options for you. I'm scrolling through this chapter on imagery to make sure that I'm not leaving anything out that I feel would be pertinent to you all. And looking at it, I think we're good. I do hope that this episode, obviously, part one of this was really setting the groundwork. This episode very much being a lot more of the intervention how-to. And then the next episode itself, a very exciting one. It's one with Dr. Brooke Rundle, where I get very vulnerable with you all and I share my mental health journey using internal family systems therapy. So some of this is acute things that you can use on your own, but I highly want to encourage your own mental health journey through this because it is a deep one, and it's one that I'm still unpacking. I'm still processing the grief of. So please give part three, which is the internal family systems known as IFS episode with Dr. Brooke Rundle, which is part three of this series, a listen. There's more information in there if you're interested in doing internal family systems therapy yourself on how to access an IFS therapist. There's more information in the show notes. I just want to thank you for showing up. This is such a compassionate for you to lean in, educate yourself on what you're going through. I'm so happy I can share my journey with you. I'm so happy that I can even just give you some of these free lectures that I have been giving to students so that you can get free access to it. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out. As always, before we leave, let's take a second to just take that full deep inhale in. And then slow exhale through the mouth, grounding ourselves more into this moment. Deep, full inhale in. Slow exhale out. I just want to say that I love you. I'm advocating for you. And I'm so proud of you for advocating for yourself. Keep going with that same flow for as long as you need. I welcome you to move on to the next episode if you would like, or I want to send you loving kindness. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be free of suffering as you move forward with your day.